Hey there, welcome to Bloodhouse, the show where we talk about art house horror movies. I'm your host, Joshua Conkle.
And I'm romantically involved with a cousin, Drusilla Adeline. Welcome to another episode of Bloodhouse.
Today we are joined by a very special guest. He is the manager of the Video Archive Cinema Club at the newly reopened Vista Theater. He is the programmer at Be Kind Video. He is Matt Landsman. How you doing? Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. Very excited to be on this show.
We talk about, and I say we, I mean me, I talk about Be Kind a lot, on here.
A lot.
Because usually when we record, it's like Sundays, and it's like, what have you been up to? And it's like, oh yeah, I went to Be Kind this week, and I dropped way too much money on VHS tapes for fucking Matt and Matt. So
yeah. She's usually giving me her money on the weekends. So
you get all that hard-earned poster money and turn it into tapes. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
and then I usually turn the tape money into more tapes.
Yes, it's a vicious cycle.
That's how hobbies tend to go. Can you tell us a little bit about Video Archive Cinema Club and what your role is there?
Sure. So basically, in France, there are these micro cinemas, and Quentin Tarantino is a big fan of these micro cinemas every time he visits Paris. And when he was reopening the Vista, which is sort of this crown jewel of LA movie theaters, there was this great idea that he would have a cinema club, not unlike those ones in France, inside the Vista Theater. And I am managing that cinema club and introducing many of the screenings. And it's a really eclectic run of programming that, I've just been taken on a cinematic journey by Quentin's choices for everything in the first month, from the films of Andrew Stone to the films of Godard to a retrospective on the great action hero Bulldog Drummond.
I was very excited to see the Bulldog Drummond stuff on the lineup. I love those movies.
I think there's like some newfound Bulldog Drummond fans as a result of the Video Archives.
You'll have to find a way to somehow screen the 1980s spoof Bullshot Crummond, which I can't even believe exists.
I heard about that, and I heard that it's based on a play, and the movie is just called Bullshot, I believe.
It's in the U.S., it was just trimmed down to just Bullshot, but in England, it was Bullshot Crummond, because they actually know who that character is in England.
Right, yeah, and he was so famously played by John Howard, who's a great actor. But I've really enjoyed just the discovery that I've made along the way of all these amazing films that were programmed for this initial lineup. And, I was watching them, in preparation for getting to actually see them in the theater. I was watching them in my home and many of them on VHS or, renting Blu-rays from different video stores around town, even Be Kind. Mm-hmm. And, out of all of them, the one that we're talking about today is the one that's hit me like a lightning bolt and was like my favorite discovery of the month.
It's pretty great. So Video Archives is the name of the video store where Quentin Tarantino worked in when he first came to LA. He bought the collection, I believe, and I know that he has a podcast under that title where he and some friends talk about those titles. Are you showing these movies on VHS? I mean, are they actually from the Video Archives video store? Or is it just... a brand
yes.
that he has now.
Many of them are on the original VHS tapes from the Video Archives video store.
That's
or
so
from
cool.
Eddie Brandt's, cool. which is another LA video store that I believe was in Van Nuys. That
it was in North Hollywood. I used to go a lot before it closed.
Right. So the Eddie Brandt's collection is part of it as well. Cool. And then, but I would say the majority, more than half of what we showed this first month is 16mm prints. So wow. at the time of this recording episode, we're hot off the heels of screening the 16mm print of the film that we're discussing tonight. So that was, really exciting to see it in that, special way.
Yeah. And I, while we're plugging things, let's talk a little bit about Be Kind Video, because I know Drusilla is a huge fan. Not that she doesn't talk about it every week, but it'd be cool to tell the listeners about it.
Yeah. So Be Kind Video is a store in Burbank in Magnolia Park area on Magnolia across from
the Goth District.
We call it a Monster Mile.
It is, and well and truly. Yeah.
You know, because we're right up there from Dark Delicacies and Blast from the Past and Halloween Town and other stores like that. And, you know, my friend Matt Renoir always had this dream of like owning a video store. And at the time that we met, I was doing pop-ups selling VHS with my friend Jamie, who goes by Hightower Video. And I met Matt through that. Doing those pop-ups, he initially, I think, bought a Scream VHS from us. And then, you know, I kept seeing him at these more and more of these tape swap events where, you know, there were more and more vendors. It was sort of like this emerging little scene, but, you know, we didn't really see it for what it was at the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he told me of his plans to open a video store in Burbank. And then it happened. And the week that he opened it, I came by, he had a Goosebumps tape for me because I'm a huge Goosebumps fan. And it kind of just evolved really organically from, hey, the horror section in the store is a little anemic. You have a lot of great horror tapes. Do you want to put some in the store? To, you know, a lot of, you know, decision making for the store and programming the events and stuff ended up coming my way. I'm very, you know, fortunate for, you know, knowing Matt and for him giving me that opportunity and believing in me, because that is absolutely what led to the video archives.
It's beautiful. Yeah. I was so fortunate enough to get to see Fright Night on 16mm at an event at Be Kind as well, because you do screening events there, and you had Tom Holland come out, and you've had people come out for Sleepaway Camp and so many incredible fucking movies. And so it's nice to be able to like walk in there on like any random day when I'm on a lunch break at Burbank and be like, I wonder what Matt and Matt are up to, pop in and walk out with an armful of entirely more tapes than I ever planned on owning in my lifetime in one go. But then also being like, oh yeah, come back later tonight, because we're going to be showing like one of your favorite movies.
Yeah, I'm so fortunate to the number of filmmakers who have agreed to give us their time. And I think that I really attribute that to the fact that so many of these movies really found their life on home video, be it VHS or Blu-ray or whatever it was. I think a lot of these horror movies, you know, didn't have these huge theatrical runs, and they had to have this like really sensational, awesome cover art with like these eye-popping bloody font on the spines and stuff like that to grab people's attention in the store. And they kind of like scarred our brains as kids, but made us really fascinated with it at the same time. And that's sort of where a lot of the VHS love for me comes from, is like, you know, seeing horror movies on the shelf when I was a kid, walking through, you know, my local video stores with my dad. And yeah, I think that a lot of the directors like kind of feel not indebted to the video store, but like, yeah, I'll show up to talk at a local video store and, you know, have this nice appreciation for a movie that maybe didn't get its flowers. Because a lot of my philosophy in programming at Be Kind has been, let's not show the thing that that filmmaker is most known for. Like, I am incredibly proud that I got to do a Q&A with Joe Dante for Small Soldiers, because he is so known for Gremlins and The Howling and, you know, Matinee and all these other things. And I don't know of any other Small Soldiers Q&As that happened. And you know, even someone like Fred Decker, we talked about Night of the Creeps, not necessarily Monster Squad. Or one that I'm really proud of is I got to sit down with John Harrison, who doesn't even live on the West Coast, who directed Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, which is a movie that I really love. And he was the composer of the original Creeps show and Day of the Dead. So, you know, we've had just like a great run of guests. And most recently, I think we had Kevin Tenney talking about Night of the Demons. And we have some more fun ones on the way. So, you know, definitely, you know, stay tuned to all the fun events at Be Kind Video. But also, you know, make sure to come and check out the Cinema Club at the Vista.
The great thing is if you go to the Cinema Club at the Vista and you go watch a movie that you've never seen before and you love it, you can then go over to Be Kind and rent more movies by that director or go buy that movie on tape probably, because the selection over there is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I try to, you know, have like a really curated selection. Like, you know, people ask us all the time, like, where are the tapes coming from? Well, it's not just like random yard sales. Like, I'm actually investing in having cool stuff that people will actually want.
Yeah. I found some absolutely insane stuff there. And I love you guys for it.
What is the one, I mean, because you're so right, the VHS, you know, horror cover is so formative for horror fans. So I'm curious, this just came to me, like, what is y'all's like most iconic horror cover, like the one that really grabbed you as a child in the
that like store? One for VHS tape?
Yeah, the one that's burned into your brain, as Matt said. For me, it's Blood Beach, which is a movie I've never seen, but that
where she's coming up out of the sand.
Yeah, she's being sucked into the sand, and it says, just when you think it's safe to get back in the water, you can't get to it. Great tagline.
Oh, yeah. Mine was definitely Fright Night. That Fright Night cover,
yeah,
like, seared into my brain. I didn't see it for, like, 20 years because of that.
Wow.
And I love that movie so much. And now my Fright Night tape is signed by Tom Holland, thanks to the Be Kind screening.
Which was a 16mm screen. Mm-hmm. My friend Ciro provided a beautiful print.
What was yours, Matt? What was the one like horror tape that like burned its way into your brain?
Well, growing up, it was Creepshow. I used to see the Creepshow cover in the store, and I used to be terrified of it because it was like, how fucked up would that be to like go to buy a ticket to a movie and there's a skeleton selling the movie tickets? and that is my favorite horror movie. But as an adult and like more of like a collector, the two that I just am obsessed with are Popcorn and Chopping Mall.
Japanese popcorn one that you outside of the podcast, Matt sent me something about a Japanese VHS tape of Popcorn that he got. It's such an insane fucking cover because it's like a bucket of popcorn and some of the kernels are skulls.
Yeah, it's so fucking cool. Awesome. I've gotten really into the Japanese tapes. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. No, I was just going to say, I recently had the pleasure of hanging out with Jill Sholin to watch. We sat in my friend Michael's living room. It was her and a bunch of gays, and we watched When a Stranger Calls Back and got her live commentary on it. But we also talked about Popcorn a lot, and she seemed to have a really good time making it. That's a lot of affection for it.
Oh, yeah. I went to a great Q&A with her at the LF3 when they showed a 35mm print of that, maybe 2 years ago now.
She's really nice. And she's kind of doing a Barbara Crampton where she's like coming back into the scene and re-embracing her horror roots. And, you know, she said to us, she got really emotional. She's like, I honestly didn't know until very recently that anybody had seen these movies or cared about them. And it feels really special to be a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, she did Stepfather, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I appreciate her so much, and it's a real shame that the actor that played Toby died really young from Popcorn, because he is amazing in that movie.
Yeah, he really is. Yeah, Popcorn's so freaking underrated, and it was so hard to get for so long.
It's kind of getting its due finally. I think people are starting to talk about it, I notice, a lot on social media and like horror spaces, but you're absolutely right. It's been really underseen for a long time, hard to get to.
I've got a big old poster of it up at Be Kind right now to spread the popcorn awareness.
Well, we're all about being off the beaten path here. So just to pivot, Drusilla, have you seen anything cool since we last spoke?
So I feel like the one movie I should talk about that I got to see this week is a movie I've already seen, but I have a tie to it, and it's playing in theaters right now, and I just saw it in theaters. So the new Fair Use film from Vera Drew that is not legally approved by Warner Brothers in any way, shape, or form, The People's Joker, which, if you don't know, is the kind of like radical trans take on the Joker, which is both like satire and spoof and like anarcho-punk underground cinema, while also being a very like earnest trans coming of age movie. that was like made by Vera Drew and this group of like, you know, trans punks and freaks over the internet ever like lockdown and stuff like that, but also has like Tim Heidecker and Maria Bamford and like Bob Odenkirk and a really like varied wide cast. I had the great pleasure of being approached by Vera and our friends at Altered Innocence to get to do the poster and a lot of the campaign for that and design shirts and merch with Super Yaki in them. And so it's like rolling out into like a like nationwide theatrical release right now, which is insane since Altered Innocence is so small. And because this movie was like thought to just be like chucked in the garbage bin of legal hell for years after it like was pulled from its TIFF premiere by Warner Brothers. So like it's free, it's out there, it's in theaters, you can finally see it. I'm so honored to have been part of it. The like LA premiere, as they've been touring it around the country, as Vera and people from the cast and crew have been doing like Q&As, hit LA just this past week at the Vidiots Theater. And so I went to go show support and hang out with everyone. And it was really, really good. And like the movie plays so well with an audience and it's so fun. But about 20 minutes into the movie, like a row in the middle, I saw like someone get up and start to leave, and then two people followed behind. And I was like, I guess like people have decided it's snack break time and are going to the concessions or something. And I heard one of the people pass me and say, "That's so fucking disgusting. Oh my God." And I was like,
no.
How are you buying a ticket to this movie at like the Vidiots premiere? And you were like offended by something about like, how are you offended by like the transness or the drug use or something in this movie?
It's not like, something, you know what it is that they're like, offended by.
What are you doing? And then I saw more people go from the other side, but it was all that one aisle we're leaving. And so I was like, I did some sleuthing and like slipped out before I slipped right back in. I talked to them and they were covered in vomit.
Oh my God.
And they were like, yeah, someone in the row behind us just threw up all over a row.
No. That's a horror story. So at least they weren't transphobes. They were just really gross.
No, they were just covered in puke. And so like people were like wash it out of their hair. Meanwhile, the rest of the theater didn't even realize. They kept watching, despite the fact that the smell of vomit was kind of starting to rise a little bit.
Oh no.
But I saw so many people on Twitter later being like, or like Letterboxd being like, yeah, someone threw up on me during the People's Joker and I still loved it. I feel like this is a prime like marketing ploy, a great time to add to the lore of this movie.
For
like,
sure.
Someone threw up at the LA premiere. The People's Joker will make you throw up. Like,
it's giving, we need to start flamingos.
Making People's Joker vomit bags for all the like subsequent screenings.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That is amazing.
It was a really good time. It was so lovely. It was so great to see like so much of like queer LA film world. I ran into our previous guest Dylan Dawson at that screening, and BJ Colangelo was also there. Like it was just like a who's who. It was so much fun.
Yeah, I saw everyone there.
Yeah. What about you?
How about you, Matt? Have you seen anything cool lately?
Well, I've been very buried in a lot of the cinema club screenings, which has been amazing, seeing all these cool movies on 16 mil. But I guess like a horror movie that I'll point out that I was pretty taken with recently was this 80s movie called The Pit.
Oh, I've been wanting to see that.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Yeah, I'm in this sort of round robin online film club. And someone recommended this to me. And, you know, I feel like a lot of the recommendations have been just kind of like, here's a, you know, good movie, you should check it out. But it's like, finally, someone like recommended the exact type of slop that I devour, which is like, a, you know, an 80s movie with like evil little kid, little monsters. I love like little guy movies, like monsters that are little guys. Yeah.
Like Munchies.
Well, not that, but like most things like that, like Troll and Ghoulies and Gremlins and Critters.
Yeah,
and
I know you're a big Critters guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So anything with like little guys, I'm like really about, and this was like a little guys movie that I'd somehow missed. And, it was like, what a joy. Like, where has this been my whole life? It's basically like the Crate thing from Creepshow, where this kid is solving all the problems in his life by feeding people to these little trolls that live in a hole in the ground in the woods. And he's sort of just like an angry, horny 10-year-old who like hates his babysitter for not wanting to sleep with him and stuff. And it's pretty weird. But I don't know. I watched this on, I think, Tubi, and then I ended up tracking down the tape, as one does.
Yeah.
And wow, what a you know, just exactly up my alley type of film.
I have confused The Pit for years with The Gate, which is very much like
another. They actually have very similar energy.
Also about a hole in the ground that has little guys in it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And they're both like kids led horror movies from the 80s. I think The Gate got a sequel, but The Pit didn't.
Right.
The Gate has a sequel. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. I've seen The Gate too.
Sounds like I need to do a Pit Gate trilogy night.
The Gate is like fun. It's foundational for 80s children who love horror because it is like a PG movie. It is very kid-like. And it was pretty big. It's one of those movies that just felt so big at the time, but is kind of forgotten now in a weird way. But The Pit I saw like last year or the year before because it was on either like the Arrow app or one of those sort of boutique cult movie apps. And yeah, I really loved it a lot. It's like a Canadian tax loop movie, I think, right?
It's like one of those. It's the best kind.
It's super Canadian. And you can like hear it in like some of the actor dialects and stuff. But it's funny. Yeah. We have a lot of like my like horror toys and stuff on display at Be Kind Video, like Chucky, Jason, Freddy, whatever. And among those, I have a gate minion, the little guys from The Gate.
Yeah.
And that has become, in a way, sort of like a gatekeeper of like, are you, you know, a real horror fan? You know, like you really know your stuff.
You're like, a real one. Like,
and anybody that like points that out and they're like, it's the thing from The Gate. I'm like, yeah, you get a sticker, but you can't have that. But thank you for noticing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Josh? What's been like going on? So what's lighting your engine?
Last night, I finally saw something I was overdue to see, and I won't talk about it long, but just to say I really liked it. Speak No Evil, the Danish movie from last year that's getting a remake.
Oh, yeah. I just saw the trailer for the remake, which gave away everything.
Yeah.
Yes, that trailer
does. I really liked it. It was like kind of made me think of like Straw Dogs or things like that. It's kind of about manners. It's sort of like a horror version of Force Majeure, you know, it's like all about manners and people like being afraid to be impolite, much to their doom. But I thought it was super fun. And then I looked on Letterboxd and it has a lot of low ratings from people who are like, these characters are too passive.
Very hit or miss. Like,
yeah. I will go on record as saying I really loved it. But what I actually wanted to talk about was this movie that a listener recommended to me last year that I finally watched. It's an Australian movie from the early 90s called Bad Boy Bubby.
And it what?
Fucked me up so bad. The first act is so hard to watch. It is about a 35-year-old man who's stunted because he's never left one room that he's lived in his whole life with his mother, who he's having a sexual relationship with. And all he eats is bowls of bread with milk and sugar.
I'm adding this to my list right now. You've already sold me.
It's super gross. There's lots of cockroaches. Warning, Drusilla, there is a fair amount of animal cruelty. It is simulated, but it's in there. And yeah, he's just like fucking his mom and being like a man child. And you know, eventually he gets out and it turns into like a Poor Things or a sort of splash narrative where he's in the world for the first time, but he's never left this room because his mom tells him that the air is poisonous outside and they're the only two people on earth, which isn't true, of course.
That's kind of funny that you bring that up, because after the movie that we watched that we're talking about today, I was looking into Terrence Stamp and I watched part of, I didn't finish, The Mind of Mr. Soames, which is a movie he did.
Oh, yeah.
In the 70s, where he plays an infant who went into a coma and then is awakened as adult Terrence Stamp. So it's adult Terrence Stamp, like, learning how to, like, again, Poor Things, learning how to, like, be a human being again. But it was like marketed as "Can this baby kill?" and it's just a photo of Terrence Stamp. It's such a weird niche trope, but it's like, yeah. There's a few movies like that. I don't know why.
I guess I'm into them. I will say to anyone who's thinking about it, the first act is really hard to watch. It's like really grody, really upsetting. It gets easier once he gets out of the one room, but yeah, I liked it. I gave it 4 stars on Letterboxd. What can I say? I like a gross movie sometimes.
Hell yeah.
But let's talk about a movie that's not gross, but is wonderful. It is the movie that Matt brought for us from 1968, directed by Roger Vadim, Louis Malle, and Federico Fellini. It's Spirits of the Dead, a.k.a. Tales of Mystery and Imagination, a.k.a. Tales of Mystery.
A.k.a. Histoire Extraordinaire. It's like a million fucking titles. When I watched it, I put it on and it was like Tales of Mystery and Madness from Edgar Allan Poe. And then the subtitle said Spirits of the Dead.
Yeah, exactly. I love when that happens in movies. Like the mutilator has the other title card for Fall Break. Mm-hmm. I love it. So, Matt, you picked this movie. Drew and I, neither of us had seen it. I hadn't heard of it, I will admit. But you just programmed this for the cinema club. So talk to us about it.
Well, Quentin Tarantino programmed it. Okay. So I hadn't even heard of it until it was, suggested to me in the upcoming movies to watch for the Video Archives calendar. And, so obviously I was intrigued. You know, I knew very little going in. I knew horror anthology. I knew Fellini. I knew Louis Malle. So I threw it on. The way in which I first saw it was by renting the Blu-ray from Videotech, a great video rental store here in Los Angeles. From what I understand, it is sort of a hard to find Blu-ray at this point.
It was only released in the UK and it is now out of print. So you've got about $100 to drop on eBay. You could get it. Other than that, fingers crossed that Criterion puts it out here since it's streaming on their site.
But since I watched it, I liked it so much, I bought the vinyl and the tape and the one sheet.
Oh my God. Yeah, I saw that you brought your own personal one sheet out for the screening. That's so cool.
I did. And so, a little bit more backstory on this screening that we did. I just wanted to say part of what I've been doing here is like learning 16 millimeter projection. And I've been training under, an expert projectionist. And, just the way that the way that the chips fell, this ended up being the first feature film I ever projected by myself for an audience.
Whoa.
I was really proud of myself for just having learned how to do that. And the fact that the one that I got to project was my favorite one on the whole calendar for the month. And the one that I'd already been collecting all this merch of, it will like kind of always have like a special place in my heart now, because I'll be able to be like, as projectionists have told me, like you always kind of remember the first feature that you showed. And for most of them, it's like kind of like a random one. But in this case, it's a movie that I already felt pretty connected to.
You've had such turbulent, like a couple months with this movie. That makes me so happy. This movie is bonkers and so freaking fun. It also, it feels directly up the alley of this show, yet somehow it's never been brought up on this show. We've never talked about any of these three massive directors before. And it's like, this cast is like international royalty.
Well, right, I think it's part of why you haven't talked about it, if I had to guess, is because, or talked about these directors before, is most of them only have one or two max like other horror titles to their credit.
That's the thing. That's what I was going to say. They're not really horror people per se.
The only one that really did genre was Vadim.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, I guess I think of Barbarella. I don't know much about him, I guess, beyond Barbarella, which is my bad, but Yeah, so this is an auteur-driven anthology movie. It's three directors who do very loose, in some cases extremely loose, adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe stories.
But like his niche stories, too.
Yeah.
This is not Black Hat or Pendulum. This is like...
Right, it's some weird ones. We get Roger Vadim first in his... Jane Fonda led, I don't even know how to say the title of this,
Metzengerstein.
Metzengerstein.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Metzengerstein.
Yeah.
Starring
Which
Jane
I think
Fonda.
Is the last name of the countess, I think.
Mm. Yes. So it's a period piece about a countess. The middle story is William Wilson by Louis Malle, starring Alain Delon, who's really beautiful. We talk about him pretty frequently, and Brigitte Bardot. And then finally, we get Toby Dammit by Fellini, which is an extraordinary short film, I thought.
Starring a bleach blonde Terrence Stamp, looking like a ghost. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, that was
And surrounded by people who looked even worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's just a regular Fellini movie. That's not even the scary stuff.
Some of them being cardboard cutouts. My headline of the movie is that I really enjoyed it. And the first two films, I was like, this is super fun. This is like watching a Mario Bava period piece, or it's giving, it's sort of like a Hammer movie. And then the Fellini movie just completely knocked me on my ass to the point where I was like, I can't believe this is hidden inside of an anthology film. Like, this is so absolutely incredible. Which I guess is a pretty common experience of this movie, if Letterboxd is to be believed. But
interestingly enough, that the Toby Dammit had been released on its own in some markets. I don't think initially, but I do know that it got a bit of play separate from the other two films. And I think at one point it may even still be, but I'm not sure. I know it was streaming on its own at one point on the Criterion Channel.
It is still streaming on its own on the Criterion Channel. So I will say, if you're going to watch this movie for the first time, the anthology film itself, Spirits of the Dead, is streaming on the Criterion Channel permanently. It's not going anywhere. But it is an older transfer from an older DVD from about the early 2000s era.
Yeah.
So it's a little more beat up looking, but still looks great. Toby Dammit is a part of that. However, it's also streaming separately on the Criterion Channel because it was made available just as a short within their Fellini box set. So for some reason, it's on there like that. But that version is restored, is like a new 2 or 4K restoration from Fellini's estate in like 2019. And so that looks fucking gorgeous. So what I did when I watched this was I like finished William Wilson, popped out, and I watched Toby Dammit over as a short, essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, just to kind of like jump off what you were saying, like... Man, I'm sitting there watching this for the first time, and I'm digging in. I'm having fun. I'm watching Metzengerstein and William Wilson, and I'm into it.
Yeah.
But then I'm like watching Toby Dammit, and I'm like gripping the couch, like, oh my god, this is like the coolest thing I've ever seen. Like it like totally like grabbed me. New films, you know, aside whatever, it's the most exciting piece of filmmaking I've seen personally all year that like was new to me.
Really extraordinary. I mean, truly. And the other two films are good too. I mean, I really enjoyed the whole thing throughout, but it just is like, they really saved the best for last.
They did. As I was watching it, I like Vadim, but Vadim's never like my go-to guy. My girlfriend Ivory loves Roger Vadim. And so we have a lot of his movies in the house, and so we watch a lot of them, and his stuff's always like very good, not always the best. I like hit or miss with him, but I liked Metzengerstein quite a bit, and the costume design and both Fondas playing relatives was great. But then I was really taken away by William Wilson. Louis Malle's very eclectic in his filmmaking. He like tends to like change genre and style a lot, and I really, really, really love quite a lot of his movies. And Will and Wilson almost felt like a Buñuel movie. It was very, very strange, very surreal, very funny. Alain Delon is goddamn beautiful. Brigitte Bardot was great.
As always.
Their gambling sequence is incredible. All the stuff with the confessional is amazing. And I was like, this just keeps getting better and better. I know everyone says Toby Dam, it's great, but that was so good. And then like two frames into Toby Dam, and I was like, motherfucker. Like, whoa. We are on like Suspiria level filmmaking here. Good God.
Yeah, he's like playing with these like crazy like color shifts, and like they're making Italy seem like this like hellscape, and like right away you're like, we're in another world.
It's also so like metatextual to the time it was made, because like Terrence Stamp was a very successful UK actor who had like had his big hit in Billy Budd, and then like went a few other like British new wave movies, and then like landed in Italy for a couple years and very quickly did a spaghetti western, did a Pasolini movie, which is maybe Pasolini's best movie, Teorema, and then did this Fellini short all in the same year. And
interestingly enough, he was a last minute replacement for Peter O'Toole in this.
Yeah,
I read that.
Oh my God.
I was,
and they like talked to him about like, oh, and like you'll do Pasolini, and you're gonna be doing this western, and you're a Christ figure. We're retelling the Bible as a western. It's gonna be great.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was most excited for the Louis. Sorry, go ahead, Matt.
Oh, I just love that scene that Drew was saying, where they're just sort of chattering at him, and he's just sort of nodding politely, looking at these like, you know, insane kind of like almost like Lynchian visuals out the window of the car.
Yeah. I was most excited for the Louis Malle segment because I feel like he's one of the most slept on French New Wave directors in America.
Very much
or it seems
so.
That way to me. My favorite French New Wave film is The Fire Within by him, which is the
I
one.
I love that movie. The movie's so fucking depressing.
Heartbreaking movie. And
I love Zazie
Dans Le
Métro.
Oh, yes. I love Zazie Dans Le Métro.
It's so incredible.
Yeah, the Royal Tenenbaums also brought me to Fire Within because the Richie Tenenbaum scene set to
Suicide.
Yeah,
Needle singing in the
Needle in the Hay is loosely based on Fire Within. Fire Within is so fucking bleak, but it really feels like a more like masculine equivalent to Cleo from 5 to 7. And really,
those are my two
way.
Favorite French New Wave movies.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
You know me. I love movies and books about suicide. I can't help it. Sorry, I just do. I'm. It's like I'm a sucker for it.
Well, Louis Malle and Vadim were also both replacements. Because originally the anthology was supposed to be Fellini, Orson Welles, and my man, Louis Buñuel. So that would have not to knock Vadim, and not to knock Malle, who I both love, and whose segments in this movie are genuinely great and amazing. Had this been Orson Welles, Buñuel, and Fellini, this might be my favorite movie ever made. Like,
well, let's maybe, we haven't done an anthology movie before. This is interesting. Let's go through them one by one. So the first one is the Roger Vadim. It's a period piece where Jane Fonda plays a sadistic countess who, I mean, this is a hard one to talk about in a way because it's mostly montage. There's like very little dialogue. It's a lot of her riding horses.
She's a libertine who like does as she wishes. She tortures her servants. She sleeps with men and women alike, plays her little sex games, and
plays with tigers.
She has a little baby tiger. And when she finds that her neighbor and cousin, played by her
played
actual
by her brother.
Yeah, Peter Fonda. wants nothing to do with her. She gets very into him, develops a crush on him, and does everything she can to get his attention. And when she decides to burn down his stables that houses his favorite horse, she inadvertently kills him in the stable fire until a mysterious horse appears in her house. And she becomes obsessed with riding the horse until it rides her to her death.
Exactly. That's exactly it. It's got a soft focus aesthetic, I would say. It
costume
does sort
design
of look
is
like
ridiculous.
I mean, they're coming right off of Barbarella, these two. So it feels like they just used some Barbarella costumes. They're like all peekaboo belly unitards. And it has like this soft focus quality of like a tampon commercial where she's just riding through a field on the back of a horse with her hair blowing around. It's all vibes. And I like that. I'm fine with that. It does have an Italian greyhound who looks exactly like my Italian greyhound, Edie, which I appreciated.
Ivory and I did call that out when we were watching it. We're like, oh, Josh is gonna love this one because his dog's in it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one.
I like seeing her as like this sort of like female Marquis de Sade, sort of like sadist. It's funny how you see the turn in her when she kind of experiences rejection for the first time, and all of a sudden she doesn't want to like have sex with her like boy servants and stuff. She's just like obsessed with her dead cousin who's been like reborn as a horse, which it's so funny. And I think this is actually the only time that Peter Fonda and Jane Fonda had a movie together.
Yeah,
right.
The only time they ever acted on screen together. And apparently he was only shot like 2 or 3 days, but stayed for the whole shoot. And when he wasn't shooting, he was literally riding Easy Rider.
Yeah, they said that he came up with the idea of Easy Rider on this set during this movie and wouldn't stop talking about an idea for like a new Western.
I think he was related to Vadim somehow as well, right?
Well, because Jane was married to him.
Jane was married to him at this time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the co-writers of Barbarella was Terry Southern, who was visiting the set. And then he and Fonda collaborated on the Easy Rider script together.
And I think Jane only did Barbarella, so if Vadim could direct it, is what I think I remember reading that.
Yeah, they were very closely tied together, and now she talks about him as my French husband. I will also say I love Jane Fonda so much. I think she's incredible as a human being. I think she's incredible as a performer, and I think this is such an underrated Jane Fonda performance. But I will also say one of the funniest things to me is people who in the year of our Lord 2024 like dislike Jane Fonda due to her
like
politics.
My dad because of Vietnam.
I literally was at, speaking of Burbank and Magnolia Park, I was at Pinocchio's, which is a great Italian restaurant.
Love it.
That's been around forever in Burbank. And I was sitting on the patio having lunch, and like, I shit you not, a grip in his 60s was having lunch with a woman in her like 30s or 40s behind me. They were like clearly like on a shoot together. They just come off to have lunch there. And he was talking about something, and he was like, and like Jane Fonda's great. And that takes me a lot to admit, because I still don't agree with her based on her Vietnam stances. And like, it took like, everything in my body.
Vietnam War? Not, are you joking?
Not to like spit my food out and be like, you're still butthurt over Vietnam, dude? Over like Hanoi Jane? What is wrong with you?
That's what my dad calls her too. He's like, you mean Hanoi Jane? It's like, you have to move on. It was 70 years ago.
Are you still pro the Vietnam War, sir?
Yeah, we love Jane Fonda. She has my same birthday, December 21st, iconic birthday.
Wow, you missed me by 2 days. I'm the 19th.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Drew's a December birthday too. We're all
Wow. Matt and I are both Sagittarius.
I'm used to kind of getting gypped around the holidays.
Oh, me too.
I'm used to getting those combo presents.
Combo gifts, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a beach party to be seen.
Yeah, well, people
we live in LA, so
of,
sometimes
people are either out of town when my birthday happens, or it's a hard sell for birthday parties.
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely. I know that pain.
You guys
I have
both
very
just
little
need
else
more,
to say about this movie.
You guys just both need more Jewish and Muslim friends that aren't celebrating Christmas.
Yeah.
Is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, Matt Gendersign is very good, but
fun.
I will great. Say there's a lot of horse riding.
A lot of horse riding.
If
a lot
you're
of
not
hair in
into,
the wind.
If you're not into horse riding, this one's not for you. But if you're a horse girl and you like lesbian sex, this one's for you.
Yeah,
I think there's always something to be said about like the structure of anthologies, and most of the time when I watch a good anthology, it's which this one is, you can't imagine it like structured any other way. Where yeah. It's like, oh my God, like, can you imagine if like they opened Creepshow with the roaches segment? It'd be terrible, you know? Yeah. So I think it's like, I love that you're sort of riding an emotional journey in a mm-hmm. good anthology along with how the segments are structured.
I feel like most anthologies tend to like start very flashy and very strong and then dip in the middle with the weaker stuff in the middle, like buried in the middle, and then end very strong on one of maybe the single best one, with the idea being like, we reel them in and then they're stuck there and then we send them out on something great. Yeah. Spirits of the Dead ramps up as you watch it. It gets better and better and better. And it starts very good, but it like only gets better from there.
I agree. The way that you kind of ease into this first segment and you're kind of like, all right, what's going on here? They're at this castle and all that stuff. This story kind of finds its stride halfway mm-hmm. through. And then with William Wilson, I think it's like a more, and this is a segue into that. That's like a more propulsive narrative from the get-go.
Yeah.
It feels like it's the shortest.
Yeah, it really does. The speed of the edits in each short get faster and faster as you go along. And then Toby Dam, it's fucking insane. William Wilson is such a great kind of classic gothic tale. It feels like it could be out of a Buñuel movie if someone like grabs someone on the street to tell them their dream, or it could be out of like the Saragossa manuscript or something like that. It's such a crazy fucking story. And I love so much how it's like a man needs to confess to a priest at all costs.
Yeah, and it's got a really interesting aesthetic that's kind of out of time. I mean, it's clearly a period piece of some sort, but the costumes are kind of all over the place in a way that makes it feel both like a period piece and contemporary to 1968.
Most people are in like uniform of a kind that like lets it be vague.
Yeah, it's really interesting in style.
I think that one thing about this that was mind-blowing to me is the way that it inverts the doppelganger trope.
Yeah.
You've never seen a doppelganger story before where the doppelganger is the good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So since there's three stories and there's three of us, and I just covered Mitzgenderstein, who wants to cover the narrative of William Wilson?
I will, because it's easier than the Fellini one.
Sorry, Matt.
No, I'm primed and ready to spew about Toby Gannett. So go for it.
So William Wilson stars the gorgeous Alain Delon, who plays the titular character, who is an army officer named William Wilson, who is a real shitbag. And there's a framing device of him confessing to a priest that he's committed murder. And as we find out what happened, we discover that he's been kind of plagued by a doppelganger for most of his life, who is like, as Matt said, the good version of him. He goes to a card game where he plays a game of poker against Brigitte Bardot, and that goes very badly thanks to his doppelganger, and he ends up, you know, having a duel with his doppelganger, which causes his own death. That's sort of a sloppy synopsis, but
it's really great though, because like every time you learn more about this character, he does something even more reprehensible and fucked up.
Yeah, he's horrible.
He's like tying women up to like cadaver tables and like attempting to like murder them or rape them. He's like, as a child, ties up another boy and then has like a gang of other boys and a pulley system drop him into a like tub of rats. It's so insane until his doppelganger shows up and it says, all right, enough of this. Please stop. Please stop. This is too far. We've gotten too far. Which pisses him off so much.
Doppelganger shows up at boarding school or wherever.
His doppelganger shows up at every moment when he's about to basically like murder or rape someone throughout the course of his life, starting with being a kid, torturing another kid, to what I think is maybe one of the more effective scenes in the whole segment, where they're sort of in the like operating theater and he's like about to stab this girl and like cut her open and stuff,
and she still dies. It's implied she gets stabbed, and the priest says, "Oh, so she's the one who dies." And Alain Delon says, "That's not important."
And of course, the most disturbing segment in the whole thing to me is like the whipping of Brigitte Bardot when she loses the card game that he cheats at.
Yeah. It's so vicious. Oh my god. But yeah, also
she's
like
very good in this too.
I love Bridget. I love seeing Brigitte Bardot with that level of like confidence and swagger. And she exists solely to take him down a peg, which is so satisfying. Something about Alain Delon's character in this made me kept reminding me of Tom Cruise.
I don't mean that
as a negative thing, but I could see Tom Cruise easily playing William Wilson.
Totally. It's kind of a Bond scene. The card game scene reminded me of like Casino Royale or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like it's so out of step for Louis Malle to take something like this, but also Louis Malle's entire career is him taking steps outside of himself. I mean, like he directed Phantom India, which is a whole like 8-hour documentary about India.
Well,
like
he did this for the check. He wanted to fund his next movie, which I can't remember which one came after this, but he was trying really hard to fund the movie that he wanted to make next. And it took him 3 years, and this was part of it. He was like, this was like, for the meal.
Oh my God. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if you both, like, just as a little poll among the people on this episode, do you both think that there really were two William Wilsons? I think it's kind of subjective.
I think it's a great demonstration of the doppelganger as the conscience,
the guilty conscience,
which is great and really interesting, because spoiler alert, William Wilson stabs his doppelganger, who then informs him that you made a mistake, buddy, by killing me you kill yourself. And so after he's confessed his tale to the priest, he then throws himself off of the bell tower, and then they find his body in the street with the dagger wound. So it's implied that they're the same person, and it's very, very, they play it both ways very convincingly, that I like a lot. All three of these kind of end in a like long sequence of like, the first one is a long sequence of Jane rides horse. This one has long sequence of we're playing cards. And then the final film, Toby Dammit, has long sequence of driving Ferrari. And I appreciate that. And I love that so much. That like after all the kind of chaos and like quixotic setup of each of these, that they're all like, and now this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
I was just going to note, I enjoyed the very obvious dummy when he jumps to his death.
Yes.
I like it a lot.
I love that sort of stuff.
I deeply, deeply love William Wilson. I feel like William Wilson is the underrated, like, real, like, banger and gem in this, because everyone knows Toby Dammit. If you know about Spirits of the Dead, you know about Toby Dammit, and you know why it's so great and so important, even if you haven't seen it. But I will say, if you think you can just fast forward yourself to Toby Dammit, you are missing out on a really, really, really great gem of a movie. I really like this one a lot, and I think it's
I agree. You know, a lot of people seemed, I read some of the critics' reviews from the time, and I've looked at Letterboxd, and it seems like a lot of people prefer the first segment to this, but I don't. I agree with both of you that they each get better than the one before them.
Mm-hmm. This is sort of the underloved segment, because when you think about it, the poster of this movie that's become iconic most prominently features Jane Fonda.
Yeah, there's a big Richard Bordeaux head, but other than that, it's like, yeah, it's like the cell is, everyone loves Jane Fonda, she's in it, and then, you know, everyone loves Fellini, he did the best one, and then you're kind of, and like I was saying, most anthologies put their weakest stuff in the middle. I do not think this is the weakest one of the lot. I think
I don't
if if all of William Wilson was included inside of in the way that there, multiple stories are included inside of the Saragossa manuscript, it would be like 10 out of 10. If Mal had made this as a feature length movie, it would be regarded as one of his better films. I think it's great. Anyway.
Yeah.
On to Federico.
Let's talk about Toby Dammit.
Sure. So we begin with a plane landing at an airport in Rome. And on this plane is Toby Dammit, who in this universe is a famed English actor. And he's basically coming to Rome for a number of reasons. And I kind of like how it's somewhat unclear what the most prominent reason for him coming is, because his mental state is very unclear throughout the movie. And I think that it's by design that it's sort of foggy. Is he ultimately doing this for a role, or is he doing this for a car? Because as soon as he gets off the plane, he's bombarded by paparazzi, and then he's whisked away to a ridiculous talk show, which is a hilarious sequence in which he's asked a bunch of totally inappropriate questions by Italian talk show hosts, and he comes off like just like a wild narcissist while he's answering these questions. And they're asking him if he believes in God, they're asking him if he believes in the devil, and this sort of thing. And I should mention that on his way to this interview, he's in the car with a bunch of like Italian film execs, and I think even a priest, and they're just sort of grilling him about this Western Christ metaphor film that they want to produce and they want him to star in. And he's just like, yeah, sure. And I think he's basically just agreeing to all this stuff so that he can get a Ferrari out of it.
Yes, he was promised a Ferrari.
So then he goes from this hellish car ride into this hellish talk show, and then finally into this absolutely surreal awards ceremony that I can only describe as being held in some sort of cavern where all of these sort of ghoulishly made up, greased down looking, like Italian, almost undead sort of film exec ghouls and like entertainment industry types are just sort of clawing at him and putting sombreros on him, and you got women coming up to him trying to marry him, and they're just feeding him liquor until eventually they cut him off and tell him he can't have any more liquor because he's at a out of body state of drunkenness. And then he goes up on stage and gives a speech about how he's a fraud and he's suffering from imposter syndrome, and then just sort of stumbles off the stage into his Ferrari that he's been promised, and then just goes tearing through the streets of Rome until ultimately he comes to sort of a break in the road. And I have left out one very important detail about this story, which is that Toby Dammit is plagued by visions of his version of the devil, which I would say is one of the creepiest visions of the devil I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And is a extraordinarily creepy little girl who, I mean, like, she's like scarier than Reagan. Yeah. She's like just like this terrifying side eye out of this almost like Carol Ann blonde bowl cut, and she's holding this like white orb type ball. And he first sees her in the airport, and I think he sees little flashes of her throughout the story. But finally, he comes face to face with her once again at the end, and spoilers, I guess. She sort of tempts him to try to make the jump across this broken section of road in his Ferrari, and of course, he doesn't make the jump, and a metal wire beheads him. And the story ends with her picking up his head.
It should be noted that of the three Poe segments, they are all share the name of the Poe short story, except for Toby Dammit, which kind of intentionally renames it to the character's name to avoid the spoiler that is the original title of the story, which is Never Bet the Devil Your Head.
And that's pretty much all that the original story is, from what I understand. Just in some basic reading about this, the original story is basically just a guy betting the devil that he can jump a fence and then getting decapitated. I don't think anything about obviously not the Ferrari, but yeah, like anything about his like acting career and all that stuff is a part of the
it's just
story.
Like two childhood friends that like grew up together, and Toby Dammit is like a spiritualist who always says who like sees something and be like, bet the devil my head I can do that, and then just goes and does it all the time, and his friend's like, please stop saying that, and then they are at a covered bridge and there's a turnstile, and he says, bet the devil my head I can jump that, and an old man comes up out of nowhere and says, you should do it then. I'll take you up on that. And then the old man walks away with his head.
And interestingly, I read that there was there's a film that came out a year prior called The Witches that had Clint Eastwood in it. Mm-hmm. And rumor goes that Clint Eastwood only agreed to do this film so that he could get a Ferrari out of the deal. And that was sort of some of the inspiration for Toby Dammit's motive in this movie.
The Witches is another anthology omnibus film. Part of it is directed by Pier Paolo Pasolini. Is part of it directed by Fellini? I can't remember.
I haven't seen it.
2 seconds.
Well, while you look that up, I'll just say that the filmmaking in this segment is phenomenal. Like, right from the get-go, he's in this sort of weird, hellish airport. I think they did a really good job of conveying what it feels like to be in like a drunken stupor where you're almost in like an out of body state, like floating through these.
As a recovering alcoholic, I've spent many hours of my life feeling like Toby Dammit. It really conveys the hell of being under the influence and having a nervous breakdown in an airport. It's lit with orange and red lighting. Like you're in hell. There's all these weird cardboard cutouts of people. Like half the extras in this movie are actually just cardboard cutouts.
And they repurposed the cardboard cutouts from the airport and then put them in like a bus later on.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
And later in the film, when he's tearing through the streets, there's like these full size mannequins that, you're sort of asking yourself, are they people or are they mannequins?
Because you really can almost believe it's a person just standing very, very, very still. I've seen Guillermo del Toro compare this movie to Dario Argento's Suspiria quite a bit.
You can see that.
And honestly, an English-speaking person showing up at a foreign airport that is just lit like it's the bowels of hell is certainly a combination. But they do kind of both push Italian horror filmmaking forward quite a bit from where the giallo film was at the time. And I feel like the little girl depiction of the devil, which again, not in the Poe story at all, Poe depicts him as an old man, does kind of feel connected to Mario Bava's Kill Baby Kill, which came out like a year or two before, which has a very ghostly little girl who is also bouncing and rolling a ball. However, her ball is not silent and in reverse, but
I mean,
Terrence Stamp is extraordinary in this. He really, he's like under the influence the whole movie. He's sweating. The whole thing feels very grounded in his point of view. You feel like you're in a drunken stupor or like a fever dream, and it just gets worse and worse and worse with each location. It really casts a spell on you.
It does a really good job of like conveying that the things that he's experiencing may or may not be real and genuine that are happening to him. Like when he initially sees the little girl at the airport, we just see him like waving and like gesticulating in an odd way, and then we go back and see his perspective later on. And when he's at the award show, everything kind of slows down and gets quiet, and a woman next to him just leans over and says, I'm everything that you've wanted, I'm everything that you've waited for, you need to marry me, we'll like leave these lives behind, we'll have the nice perfect quiet life together, come with me, marry me, I'm the perfect person for you, I'll change your life and all this stuff. And then when he turns around, she's just not even there. And then he rants about her in his big monologue later about like, women are trying to marry me and this is not right. It very much feels like that is on you, sir. That
he was like momentarily down, though.
He was very down.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know why he wouldn't. That was a very seductive call from his subconscious. I will say his big speech that he gives might be some of the best acting Terrence Stamp has ever done. I love Terrence Stamp.
He's a really great actor.
He's an incredible actor. And we're still lucky to still have Terrence Stamp with us. Mm-hmm. I think he's fucking phenomenal. But I think Toby Dammit might be his best performance ever. I saw an interview with him where he was saying that Fellini was one of his favorite directors to work with, but that when they had like tough scenes to film that were like really taxing and tough for him, that were like done in close up, that Fellini would be squatting underneath the camera, like huddled up to Terrence Stamp's leg, like petting his leg and saying, "It's gonna be okay. You got this. You got this. You got this. You can do this." Like during the take.
So weird.
He was like, he was there to just take care of me, and he took care of me, and he understood, and he made it easier for me. And I'm like, yeah, Federico's just like cuddling up to you, petting you to help get you through the scene.
He does such a good job of just like almost like that like drunken state of like astral projecting where your face is conveying one thing, but obviously something else completely is going on in your mind. He's just sort of grimacing and half listening to everything everyone is saying to him and just sort of like, I don't know, like pretending to be this character of this famous actor until he can't pretend anymore. And just his facade totally shatters when he reaches like a state of like the height of drunkenness and just sort of crashes down on his own sense of imposter syndrome. I just think it's an incredible just like layered performance, and it's very sad, but it's also like really funny. Parts of this are really funny.
Yeah.
Fellini somehow in like 40 minutes is able to make one of the funniest, saddest, and scariest movies you've ever seen.
It's
and
really,
most beautiful.
Really excellent.
Stamp is showing up to work. They're all really putting it all into this. They're not treating it as like, let's collect a check for an anthology movie.
Yeah. That's why it's so surprising. Originally when I was like, why is this hidden in an anthology movie? I have to be honest, I really liked all of these, but I can't imagine a future me deciding to just watch Toby Dammit on Criterion or YouTube or whatever. Like I think I would revisit that one alone happily.
Yeah, I get that.
Another thing about this that really struck me was the Nino Rota soundtrack. Famous composer of The Godfather, but I find myself listening to this soundtrack a lot nowadays, and I even bought the vinyl of it. It just has a really fun kind of like bouncy main theme that feels kind of classy, and then there's like these sad derivations of it and just sort of like creepy versions, slowed down versions. All the different mood ranges of Toby Dammit are conveyed really perfectly in this theme song that is sort of repeated almost continuously throughout the movie, but it really works.
Mm-hmm. And it's also weirdly prescient because, you know, it is a movie very much about 1968 in a way. It's about all of the excesses of substances and sex and, you know, swing in London and all of that. And it kind of the warnings about all of those excesses, which isn't very, I mean, it's happening in the moment of 1968, and not a lot of movies were that prescient or self-aware. I mean, that's something you get a lot in the 70s when all of the free love stuff has already crumbled, but you're getting it like in the moment where it's just like something that people didn't really predict at the time, except for maybe Joan Didion, who like wrote some pretty scathing essays about the hippies.
I will say it's also outrageously prescient, and I'm less so prescient and more just like speaking to the times when this movie was made, that this movie was shot in and around 1967, released 1968. There was a very famously reported incident of a very famous film star losing their head in an automobile collision in 1967. Jane Mansfield's death.
Yeah,
right. Happened like a little bit before, if not during, this film's production. So either that was a large source of inspiration for Fellini choosing this story and transposing it in the way that he did, or it's an outrageously macabre, unintended synchronicity. But good lord,
there's something right so the eerie about how this ends, because the whole movie is in his head, and then when his head is like laying on the ground and we're left with this grinning devilish little girl, it's sort of you feel like you're seeing something you're not supposed to see. You're seeing like the time after time ends as we know it, like this world like shouldn't exist without this character, and then we're just literally left in hell.
Well, and the way that the movie as a whole has ramped up and kind of sped up in pace as we go along to the final moments when you're just left with that feel so jarring and so slow and time really stands still. And then the movie's over. Bye. Get out. Like,
yeah,
the movie like builds you up, drops you and leaves you alone.
Yeah.
And it's jarring. such a haunting, shot, the way that Fellini, choreographed, like the actual beheading. You don't see like that, you know, tacky horror movie kill of a head flying through the air. Instead, you just see the wire coming into mm-hmm. focus. And then slowly as it emerges, into the front of the camera, you see that it has blood on it and you understand what it means. And you just have this sense of dread. You know that he's on this, you know, collision course for, you know, you know that he's doomed as soon as he gets into that Ferrari, but it still really affected me when I saw the blood on the metal wire.
Yeah. It's powerful.
Well, let's play our favorite game, Have They Seen It? The game where we speculate wildly whether notable figures have seen this movie. I have someone in mind. Jane Fonda is in this. We talked about her husband, Roger Vadim. She had many husbands. One of them was, you know, titan of cable television, entrepreneur Ted Turner of Time Warner Cable fame.
And of Turner Classic Movies.
Turner Classic Movies. Do you think that he has seen this? Is this too obscure for Ted Turner and his classic movies?
Yeah.
I bet he turned it off.
Yeah, I bet he saw his wife with a woman or on a horse and was like, nope.
You don't think he was turned on by that? You don't think he finished the first segment?
He probably finished the first segment and then turned it off.
I mean, yeah. He was from Atlanta. Maybe he was very into his wife orgasming on a horse. I don't know. I have no way of knowing. I don't feel I feel like if he had seen it, even part of it, he would have watched it before he married Jane. I can't imagine that he stashed away copies of this and Barbarella for when Jane was out of town and was like, oh, I need my fix. Oh, Jane. Oh, God. I don't feel like that was Ted Turner's life in any way, shape, or form.
Well, actually, I forgot that he's Ted Turner of Turner Classic Movies, and I know some programmers from Turner Classic Movies listen to the show. So if you can let us know if you happen to know if Ted Turner ever saw this, or if you ever could program this for TCM, we would love that.
Yeah, this is very much a TCM staple. Like, yes, yeah. Please.
They do some cool stuff, TCM. Those are good programmers over there.
TCM, I mean, fucking rules. Will always stand for TCM. And as much as I love Criterion 24/7, which I now just have playing on my TV all the time in my house because I don't have cable and I can't have actual TCM, it comes very close.
Yeah. Drusilla, do you have anybody in mind?
I do. Someone who's mentioned by name in this movie. And who Terrence Stamp worked with around this time, and who was also no stranger to the anthology film, which like was such a popular format in the 60s. There were so many anthology horror movies from Amicus and from AIP, but also like anthology art house movies. There was like Boccaccio 70 and Rogopagi. Like they were getting Godard and all these people to make anthology films. It was like in the air. And I think they also just had some short films they didn't know what to do with. So do you think that other Italian filmmaking legend Pierpaolo Pasolini, who also worked with Fellini as a screenwriter early in his days, saw Spirits of the Dead? Again, he had just shot with Terrence Stamp the year before in De Arima.
He absolutely must have.
Yeah. I feel like I dig this movie.
It seems like he would have, but I could also imagine it where he's just like, you know, too fucked up, and I don't know much about Pasolini's personal life in the 60s. I mean
this was considered a prestige film of its time. Mm-hmm. And
especially in Italy, you know,
yeah, and with the director choices that they made, especially, you know, when you look at what they originally intended, like you were talking about with Orson Welles and stuff, they were not selling this as like you know, how later anthologies like Creepshow would later be sold.
It's not this, a drive-in this was movie.
It was sold as a drive-in movie in America, though, because America, we're because
it was released by AIP, who did drive-in movies primarily. Yeah.
Which is really satisfying because I know Roger Corman loves these directors, so I'm glad that he got to like kind of like help put some of the stuff out, but of course he would only get the horror one.
He also has extraordinary taste, Roger Corman.
Exactly.
Matt, do you have anyone?
Okay, sure. So this is a pretty wild take. My first exposure to Terrence Stamp as an actor when I was younger was in a little movie called The Phantom Menace.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm wondering if George Lucas saw this movie.
My gut says no. I
know he's
like
a big
Star Wars movies.
I know he's a big Japanese film aficionado. He loves him some Kurosawa. He loves him some
Ozu. That makes sense.
I mean, the first Star Wars movie is basically a soft remake of The Hidden Fortress. So,
yes.
Like, down to the wipe edits. Like,
I would actually think that he did, because he was such a, you know, a student of film in this time, in 68, when this came out. With, you know, and he was with his contemporaries like Spielberg and Coppola and stuff. I feel like he probably did. This was like a prestigious film that would have been inspiring to, you know, young filmmakers in that era, in like the late 60s, early 70s.
I also feel like for a lot of those people of that era, like Fellini is a name that's talked about a lot. People were probably familiar with In God Created Woman and Barbarella for Vadim. Louis Malle, I think, was significantly less famous in the US at the time. He became more famous in the 70s and 80s here. I feel like this was like the easy way to get into a lot of these filmmakers for film students and for like teenagers in the 1960s to be like,
right.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm like down to go watch 8 and a half, but like, let's go see his Edgar Allan Poe movie. Like, oh, I remember like my dad talked about In God Created Woman back in the 50s and how like, damn, Brigitte Bardot is fucking stacked in that. Let's go down to the drive-in and watch them in Spirits of the Dead. Like,
well, even now, I feel like an easy way to like trick, you know, your less open-minded friends into watching this is by just telling them it's a horror anthology. It's Poe, you know.
Yeah,
that's like an easy sell. And then, of course, you know, they're in for this whole cinematic journey.
I mean, especially like the Fellini one being so strong, and the Fellini one also feels the most like a Fellini movie. Like, if you like Toby Dammit, you're gonna love Julie to the Spirits. You're gonna love 8 and a half. You're gonna love Emma Horde. Meanwhile, if you really like William Wilson, maybe you're like Black Moon. Like,
you'll love Zazie Dantlemetro.
Yeah, you'll love Zazie Dantlemetro. If you have a soul, you'll love Zazie Dantlemetro. I mean, come on.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for bringing this movie. I'd say that we both loved it. It's really a cool one.
And also, knowing you as like a like 80s VHS horror guy, I was like so prepared for you to bring like The Thing or something like that, or something like Chopping Mall. But
you said art house, and I of course Chopping Mall and popcorn and stuff came to my mind, but I was like, I can't get away with that.
I was excited to watch you try though. I loved this movie so much. Thank you so much for bringing this, and thank you so much for coming on. I love hanging out with you, dude.
Yeah, Matt, where can people find out about you and your comings and goings?
So you can follow me at Matt's Mortuary on Instagram, at Matt Lansman on X/Twitter. If you want to hear more about the video store, it's at Be Kind Video on Instagram. And if you want to hear more about the video archives at the Vista, it's at Video Archives Club on Instagram. And then that's also, I think, just at Archives Club on Twitter. There's a lot of different ways in which you can reach me or learn about, you know, the movies that I'm helping put on screenings for.
And if you're LA based and you need something to do, we've just given you a laundry list of places to go and eat.
100%.
And if you've never been to LA, we just gave you a really good travelogue.
Drusilla, where can people find you?
My art and I are over at sisterhighdesign.com. I think the latest stuff over there is Late Night with the Devil. And I think there's going to be some more music-related stuff popping up soon, and a lot more posters coming soon. I'm a busy little bee. Tons of stuff over there. You can also contact me over there. You can also track me down on Letterboxd if you look for Sister Hyde or Drusilla Adelon. You can follow me on there and see what I thought of a 90s Hong Kong action movie starring Rob Schneider and scored by the band Sparks. And you can also find me on Instagram if you look for Hyde Sister. What about you, Josh? How can people race their Ferraris to your door?
I am at Joshua Conkle on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Letterboxd. And the TV show that I write for finally came out, so please watch Dead Boy Detectives on Netflix. It is out now, and I want to do season 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 so that I stay gainfully employed. So please just put it on and do your laundry and just let it play.
I can't wait to watch it. I'm so excited for it.
What are we watching on the show next week, Drusilla?
Next week, we are sticking with one of the two nationalities of this movie. We're going to France, and we are going to get a little preggers and watch the French extremist movie Inside.
Yay, I can't wait.
Which I'll also take a little bit of credit for Inception.
Yes, Matt, yeah. It was on his list, and I was like, well, let's just do that next. It's easy.
So we'll be doing 100%. A lot of Matt's lists soon.
Yeah. We're very lazy here. We don't do a lot of planning ahead, as you can see. Thanks, everybody. See you next week. Bye.
Thank you.